Hey guys, I'm Mirban Aranchad, and we're here at Tennis Summit 2018 to talk about developing a technically sound serve with my friend Ian Westerman. And Ian is a really considered a pioneer in the realm of online tennis instruction. He is the founder of Essential Tennis, and Essential Tennis has produced an incredible amount of free, super high quality and value-filled videos that have helped millions of people improve their tennis games. I'm really proud to say that Ian has crossed the 110,000, almost bordering 120,000 subscriber mark. So it's really incredible with, you know, all the work he's put in, him and his team. Ian has also created tons of amazing premium tennis courses at EssentialTennis.com. And Ian was also featured in Forbes as one of the most successful online tennis instruction entrepreneurs ever. And Ian also has one of the most popular tennis podcasts of all time with a ton of fantastic episodes called the Essential Tennis Podcast. So we're fellow podcasters, which is kind of cool. And Ian and his team, most importantly, share the same passion as you do, which is to help people become better tennis players and really just reach the next level in our tennis games. Ian also spent a considerable amount of time in the D.C. area, which is where I'm from, because he coached at the Congressional Country Club. So that's pretty cool, too. And most importantly of all, Ian is actually phenomenal at driving stick shift. It's
incredible. Life skill, man. Life skill.
Yeah,
although,
yeah.
It's kind of going away. You don't see a whole lot of stick shift anymore. But, yeah, every car I've ever owned was stick shift. So outside of, like, you know, the family car is automatic, but yeah, big fan of manual.
Yeah, that's taking control, you know, that's important.
Exactly.
Yeah, fantastic stuff, Ian. Well, obviously, it's really a pleasure to have you on again on this year's summit. Last year, you had a great presentation for us on volleys, and now we're talking about the most important stroke of all, in my opinion, at least, the serve. So really a pleasure to have you on. And so I guess I just wanted to get into most a broader question before we kind of like go into the video analysis. And, you know, for you, you know, why is the serve like so such a critical part of our games?
The cliche answer, not cliche. I mean, there's somebody that once said, you know, things that are cliche are that way because there's truth to them. And everybody, you know, says the serve is the most important shot. I think for good reason, because it begins every point. It's the only opportunity that we have to start things completely on our own terms, completely within our own control. And so if we're not maximizing that opportunity, then we're just leaving results on the table. But I think that combined at kind of the crossroads of how difficult it is for the average tennis player to really grasp a high quality, fundamentally sound service motion, the importance of the shot in tennis, and kind of meshed with how difficult it is for your average tennis player to really get it and really create a flowing kind of natural service motion, really kind of makes it doubly important, in my opinion, to really get things fundamentally sound and flowing smoothly.
Yeah, that's great advice. You know, I'm curious to just ask you, you know, have you ever had struggles with your serve, and like what type of things kind of helped you develop it into a great stroke?
I mean, I don't want to be that guy who's like, nope, it's always been amazing. But like, I've never, honestly, it's always been, there are two shots for me that have always come very intuitively and have just always been confident for me, are my serve and my volleys. So good choice by you to pick volleys last year and serve this year. But no, I remember very little, honestly, of my lessons of being taught like the racket. You know, we tend to get people, coaches and players who love digital coaching, I think, love to get really far off in the weeds of super technical analytical stuff with the serve motion. And I think for good reason. I mean, it's a technically complex motion for sure. But I don't remember as a child being taught, you know, to swing up on edge or to pronate or to have a good racket drop or any of that stuff. And so I think for me, I was lucky that I grew up in a very kind of typical boy atmosphere. I had two other brothers. We were homeschooled. We spent a lot of time in the backyard playing baseball and football and basketball, but baseball and football in particular, just getting a lot of reps in as a young child, throwing overhand, I think was really critical in my tennis development, my serve development. And it's something that a lot of our viewers I know don't have that luxury of having grown up really spending a lot of time throwing stuff in the backyard as effective, you know, snowballs and sticks and rocks and stuff as effectively as possible. And I think that honestly had a lot to do with how confident my serve has always been. And to this day, even though I could go months without playing, my serve always just comes back to me. And there's things I could definitely improve about it, especially now that, you know, I've spent many, many years analyzing technique, and I see the flaws in my own serve. And so I could, of course, make it better and fundamentally more sound and better executed. But generally speaking, it's always been a really confident swing for me.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And yeah, it's really cool, you know, to watch your in-depth studies and lessons that you put on, you know, that are like 20 minutes a lot of times or more on YouTube, because you show the students the principles of the technique. And the cool thing too is a lot of times you're just having them throw things, like throwing footballs or, you know, yeah. So those are like the basic things that, you know, you mentioned that you were fortunate enough to do at a younger age, so that kind of it developed your technique, you know, and flow. So that's really great. But
yeah, the fundamental elements of any overhand motion are basically the same, with some small differences between sports and what the release is like, and what the, you know, what angle are we trying to make the thing go as it leaves our body. There's some nuances between the sports, but the basic principles of just like any other powerful, you know, full body motion of leading with the body, using the kinetic chain well, having the arm and shoulder be relaxed enough that it can actually move efficiently and smoothly and naturally. Those things are definitely universal among different overhand motion sports. And so, yeah, we do use a lot of other kind of outside non-tennis-y things to try to get players to feel what it's like to swing more biomechanically efficiently.
Yeah. Great stuff. Out of science terms. cool stuff, Ian. So I guess, you know, at this point, with that fantastic background and the fundamentals, I'm going to shift to just asking you questions about the serve, you know, starting with the grip. And so feel free at any time mm-hmm. to, you know, share whatever videos you might think would help. But I just want to ask.
I'm going to find a racket too. Here we go.
Oh, yeah. Sweet.
Got one.
Oh, nice. Which one's that?
This is the Phantom Black racket with purple stripes.
Phantom racket. Nice. That's
with no buck cap or branding anywhere on it. We won't get into that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah. All right, that's a conversation for another day, or never. But cool. Well, thanks for bringing the racket out. So obviously, you know, we're going to start with the grip, and I was just curious. You know, obviously, this is important, and you know, a lot of you out there may be saying, "Oh, you know, like I already know this," but it's really important to, you know, get the fundamentals straight. And so, I want to ask you, you know, obviously, like, what is the optimal grip for us, and also like the acceptable ranges as well for the serve.
Yeah, the grip is critical, and just kind of taking one kind of step back or painting the picture a little bit more broadly. The reason why grip is so important is because one of the main themes or types of technical focus that we see over and over and over and over again with our students when they come into Milwaukee to work with us is the difference between a pushing motion up towards the point of contact versus a pulling motion. And pushing, meaning the racket faces is open and the strings are presented up towards the point of contact. And it's just a very weak way to swing towards the ball. There's very little racket head speed being generated. That is as opposed to the edge of the racket going up first. And this we refer to as more of a pulling motion, pulling the racket up towards the ball and then releasing the get a little bit better angle here, and then releasing the racket face up towards contact. this is a universal movement among high professional, high level tennis players or any other overhand athletes. Whereas the pushing racket strings, leading the swing kind of framework is pretty universal among lower to intermediate level tennis players. So the reason why the grip is important is because, that's a little too far. As the grip goes more towards a forehand grip, whether that be Eastern forehand or semi-Western forehand, the strings open more and more and more. And that just kind of naturally leads the player towards more of a pushing motion. Whereas a continental grip puts the racket on edge with the frame leading, and then you're forced, in effect, you have no choice but to have to rotate your shoulder and your forearm and your hand to get the strings facing towards the ball. And that is, doing that correctly is what players and coaches refer to as snapping the racket. And I think there's a lot of misconception out there about what that is. I think a lot of players think that snapping means hinging forward or flexing forward at the hand or the wrist. And it feels like that. Snapping meaning the racket head releasing and at the very last moment accelerating and creating a lot of racket head speed through the point of contact. But it's not from this kind of motion. It's from this kind of motion, which is extending the arm, rotating the shoulder, rotating the forearm. That's the snaps that a lot of players and coaches refer to. And all of that is not possible without the racket going up on edge, which is why the grip is super important. It kind of sets you up for success in the first place. It doesn't completely take out the possibility of opening the racket up too early, but it makes it much easier to go up towards the ball correctly on edge.
Yeah, that's a great explanation, Ian. Really appreciate that. And so, you know, with that continental grip, that's really important. I mean, if we're shifting it a little bit, let's say if you're a right-hander, a little bit towards the Eastern, so maybe it's like halfway in between continental and Eastern. I mean, is that like acceptable as long as we can get like that sort of edge leading, or would you still recommend we go pure continental?
Oh, man. I definitely have some wiggle room, in my opinion, for volleys on grip, as long as it's the same grip on both sides. Serve is a tough one, man. Like I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that this is one of the most common flaws that we see among all of our students at all different levels is just the racket face opening up too early. And let me show you a quick example of that. We have this is one of our students that we worked with in Costa Rica and in California also. This was Caroline's take back position before we started working with her. And this was as low as her racket dropped and her strings immediately as she took her racket back were facing up towards the sky, up towards where she was going to be making contact. And we see this over and over and over and over again. And so I'm really hesitant to be like, oh yeah, sure. As long as it's close, it's fine. Because it's such a pervasive problem, and it limits players so dramatically with how much racket head speed they're able to generate. I'm not going to say it's impossible with kind of a strong continental to still get the racket on edge and still have a fundamentally strong motion. I'm sure it's possible, but I'm hesitant to endorse that at all just because it's such an extreme, you know, extremely common issue that we see from players.
Yeah, I mean, that's great advice. I appreciate that, Ian. I mean, why not just use what you know works for sure? So that's great.
And yeah, I hate to be legalistic about stuff like that. Like, I'm not one to be like, no, you have to use, you know, continental or else your serve will always suck. Like, I'm sure there's examples out there of like a stronger continental and still doing everything else, you know, the way that you're supposed to. But I can't officially be like, oh yeah, you know, it's as long as you're close, no big deal. Because I just see the opening of the face so frequently.
Yeah, no, that's definitely great advice, Ian. And so, you know, for those of us out there who, you know, are kind of uncomfortable with this change, let's say we shift it and then, you know, obviously it feels super weird. Or, I mean, what type of advice do you have for us so that we can make sure we kind of follow through and then work at it?
Well, I'm not going to BS anybody watching. I mean, it's a big change. In particular, if you've played tennis for a long time already and you've had a forehand-ish grip, you know, for 5, 10, 20 years, it's a completely different paradigm of swinging the racket. And actually, one of my colleagues, Tomas at Field Tennis, maybe we can link to this someplace, Mirabhan. I don't sure. have the title like handy, but he did an excellent video on this topic of why serving correctly is so difficult. It, like the title was something along those lines. It was something like why is the tennis serve so difficult was basically the title.
Cool.
And one of the big framework differences between pushing and snapping is somebody who's used to a pushing motion. If you can imagine, like my intended target is basically at the camera, you'll frequently see very low level or very beginner players come up to the baseline and essentially set themselves up facing their target. And you see this kind of thing where it's like, well, I want to hit the ball this way, so all right, I'm going to line myself up, line up my strings, and make the ball go that way. And it makes sense, right? It's like, okay, well, I know the racket face directs where the ball goes, so I'm just going to line all this up and just put the ball in the box. And then as they start to try to develop their serve a little bit more, they'll maybe turn a little more sideways and start to go through a little bit more of a, you know, longer motion. But the general approach of facing their target instead of getting sideways is a huge difference. So I would say for somebody who's looking to make the transition, make sure that you're rotating your body initially strongly and setting yourself up with a grip so that as you go up towards the ball, you're basically approaching it from more of a side-on direction relative to your target. And this is hard for players to get comfortable with because where they're lined up and where they're going to be hitting the ball are two different directions. And so I think for a lot of players that seems really counterintuitive and they're just not comfortable with that. And they feel kind of like misaligned or out of place. And so it's easy for them to just go back to the norm, you know, their kind of normal way of doing it, which is much, much weaker and much less potential for acceleration. I don't know if that really answered your question or not, but I think that's kind of what it comes down to. Tomas and his video did a really good job explaining it. So if you could link to that, I think it would be a really good resource for your viewers.
Cool. Really appreciate that explanation. And also the resource that sounds great. Mm-hmm. And so Ian, I mean, obviously super important stuff about the grip. So kind of to move on to, I guess, you know, like the first move after that, which is really, I guess, okay, let's talk about the footwork alignment first off. I'm just curious, you know, if you have a preference between platform and pinpoint, especially, you know, considering that we want our best to try to get the fundamentals correctly. So I don't know if there's one that facilitates that better than the other for, like, let's say, like the 3-0 to 4-5 range.
Sure. Yeah. The more I teach, the more I'm more of a fan of platform, just to define that real quickly, just simply meaning, again, if I kind of, this is my intended direction of target, starting with the feet wide and apart and having them, I don't want to hit anything, having them stay wide up until the point of going up towards the ball, and then everything rotates and feet, you know, shift up into the air and forwards, as opposed to starting wide and coming together kind of as trophy pose initiates, or starting with the feet together and leaving them, you know, relatively close together. Now, when you watch professional players, you'll see all three of those variations. And so, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, like, this is not an area where I'm like putting a flag in the sand and I'm like, you must use, you know, hybrid, you know, platform and then slide the foot forwards to pinpoint or whatever. That's what I happen to use. As I teach more and more, I'm a big fan of platform simply because I think it more naturally leads a player to good things. Having a stronger rotation initially, a stronger trophy pose position, which loads and kind of coils the body, and helps them avoid rotating forwards too early as well. and helps keep them from kind of aligning forwards and just kind of pushing forwards at the ball. So I think there's a lot of good things that kind of naturally result from the platform stance, starting wide and staying wide up until the point of contact. That's the way Federer does it. That's the way Sampras did it. But you've got like Karlovic and Isner, you know, two of the best servers of all time that started wide and came forwards. So at the end of the day, I think it's kind of an aesthetic, individualistic thing. As long as the other fundamental elements are there, then it's fine either way. But if I were to start a player from relatively beginner, I would probably start with platform because it's more simple and it kind of tends to lead players towards some better movement patterns.
That's super helpful, Ian, you know, especially with a lot of the audience being more on the amateur side, it's better to probably use the platform stance and get the fundamentals correctly. And yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of players kind of think that if they use the pinpoint, then they can like step forward and like launch into it. But then they forget about all these fundamentals that you're talking about, like the proper rotation and weight shift and stuff. So,
yeah, that reminds me of kind of one caveat. If you're a hardcore doubles player or a singles player that likes to serve and volley a lot, I think that would be the one kind of auxiliary like element where I kind of like the pinpoint or hybrid better. I think it's easier to transition body weight and kind of push forwards into a serve and volley kind of footwork pattern from pinpoint or hybrid. You can still do it, you know, from platform, but just a little kind of side note there.
Yeah, no, actually, that's great. I really do appreciate you pointing that out. And just curious, too, you know, kind of getting in the weeds here, but with the platform stance, you know, if you could kind of describe, you know, the fundamentals, like as far as like the width and where it should be. And also, maybe more importantly, too, like any mistakes that you see players make when they're lining up into the platform stance.
Yeah, sure. I think width should be just a little bit more than shoulder width. Should definitely be comfortable. There's no need to be much wider than full width unless maybe you're going to slide forwards. But if you're going to stay wide and go up to the point of contact from a wide base, I think just a little bit more than shoulder width is definitely adequate. As far as mistakes are concerned, I think players, again, kind of coming back to this same theme, tend to line themselves up more open than what they should be. And I've definitely had players shift towards more of a platform stance just to get them a little bit more turned and a little bit more coiled right from the get-go, kind of from their starting position. So I would say, I don't know. I can't say I really see any players lining up too wide. Like, that's not really a mistake I see. So I would say players tend to be kind of on the narrow side of things, and they tend to be on the open side of things, meaning their hips and their chest facing more forwards than what would be ideal. So I think those are the two things to kind of look out for, and strongly recommend that anybody watching this who's trying to self-diagnose and improve their own game, record yourself. Always record yourself and see what the heck you're doing, because you don't know unless you see it. You might think you know, but you don't know. And so record yourself and see what you're doing with your feet. More than likely, at best, you're getting to 90 degrees to the baseline unless you're already above a 4 or 5 player. And I'm definitely always trying to help my students get at least a little bit past that, to where their chest is facing towards the back curtain, or their back is facing towards the net, at least a little bit. You really don't see any professional players that aren't going a little bit past 90 degrees with their initial coil of their body. And having the right width of stance and the right foot positioning really helps get that set up right out of the gate.
Yeah, great stuff again, Ian. One quick, I guess, maybe sidebar, if you want to call it. I've had a lot of, I've had some players where I've told them by email and said, hey, you know, just send me a video of your stroke and I'll give you some help there. And I heard nothing, you know, back. So I just want to get from you, like, how easy is it to, like, you know, to take this video? Because I feel like a lot of people kind of get lazy and they think like, this takes like a professional camera or something, and then they don't do it. But it's really important to videotape yourself, like you said. So you have any advice for us on that?
I've been making content on this topic for over a decade now, which makes me feel really old, but I can't even emphasize strongly enough how accessible it is now. I've got my iPad right here that we use with all of our students. It's got probably over 1,000 clips in here from all of our most recent coaching students. We don't coach without video every single step of the way. And now frequently we're using like multiple like iPads, getting different angles of like the same shots so we can compare positions and habits and patterns from multiple angles at the same time. If you have a phone that was made in the last 5 years, then you have a good enough camera in your pocket already. The app that we use is called Coach's Eye, and definitely highly recommend that. It's super simple, but very powerful program. And of course, a newer phone or newer iPad would be great, but anything that you have right now will get the job done. I don't think it's laziness, Mirabhan. I think the biggest thing that keeps players from doing it, there's two things. There's the social like awkwardness of being the guy or gal on the court that sets up the phone and sets up the tripod and the basket of balls and like hit serves, because nobody does. It's just not a part of tennis culture. And I think that's, if I could help like make one change in the world of tennis, it would be to make recording oneself normal, because there's like for whatever reason, there's like an awkwardness about recording yourself that everybody has, just as far as like what everybody else around you sees. And like, oh, wow, what are you doing? Cause nobody does it. And so it's kind of strange to be the odd person out. But the other part of it that I think is more prolific is that players are afraid of what they'll see if they do it. I think that's by far the biggest thing holding players back. It's not that they're lazy. They work hard, but they're really afraid that when they finally see the truth, there's going to be that moment of reckoning where they're like, there's no place to hide. Like whatever is happening, it's like right there. You can't hide it. The camera doesn't lie. And so I think it's really intimidating for players. And that's the number one thing that keeps them from knowing the truth about their own game.
Yeah, that's great stuff, man. And it really is true, because I finally, got the stones to videotape myself a while back. And then I was like, oh man, what the heck is this hitch that I have? So it's really important to, to do that, so you can discover, whether it's with a coach or someone like Ian, or even on your own, like what types of things you.
And let me just throw in one more thing on that before we get back to serve technique. Just for everybody watching this, just understand that you're severely limiting your improvement by not knowing what you're actually doing. You can go like take all kind of lessons and do drill groups and work with ball machine and all that, but if you don't know what you're actually doing in real life, then you're just totally guessing about what to work on. Or you're picking something that's not even close to the most important, obvious, thing that's a flaw in your strokes. Number one. Number two, you're not fooling anybody else by not recording yourself. Everybody else at your local courts knows how crappy your serve is, or your backhand is, or whatever. Like that, you're not hiding it from anybody else but yourself. And that's something that actually one of my viewers pointed out not too long ago during a live coaching session. I thought it was like actually a really profound like statement. Like if you're gonna hide, you're only hiding from yourself. Everybody else knows the truth. So you might as well be in on the secret and find out what it is you have to work on and actually overcome those flaws.
Excellent stuff. Very important, sidebar, if that's the right term. So everybody, videotape yourself, please.
Just do it.
just do it. That's right. So great stuff, Ian. So, now on to the pretty much the first move, as far as the stroke, because you see a lot of mistakes made there, and it's really important. So can you kind of describe for us, once we're set in our, let's say, platform position, and we've got our hands together, what type of technical aspects we should be thinking about?
Yeah, sure. Is it fair to say you're asking for trophy pose for your bond, or are you talking about a little bit past that?
Oh, sorry. So, like, I guess from the point at which we are in our starting position, and then from there to like the rotating to get into our pro trophy position.
Okay, sure. And we don't quite have the beginning of Caroline's stroke here, but you can see here the example on the left side of this split screen. Here we go. Yeah, so Caroline's just starting here. The clip on the left. Her hands are together. I think the most important thing is immediately getting to that strong coiled position and setting the racket in an edge position right from the get-go. We've talked about both those things already. And yeah, let's go ahead and just kind of visually point out what that looks like. So here you can see Caroline's feet are really close to being at the same width, the same position, and be much, much better if her right foot was further back to help her rotate her hips back and rotate her shoulders back, which we were talking about before with the platform stance. And let's contrast that really quick. All right, so this is Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
He's one of the coaches here at Essential Tennis. And so contrast that with Kevin's feet, which, sorry, his right foot's not quite in the frame here. But you can see there's more of an – he's creating more of an angle with his feet, whereas Caroline was a little bit more perpendicular to the baseline with her feet. And so that gives Kevin a little bit more room to rotate and kind of coil himself back. You can see his hips are turning back towards the back fence a little bit, his shoulders even more so. And so there's his body is twisting and turning, and that's creating potential energy to rotate back forwards again. And then the other big difference is that as Kevin kind of completes his load with his body, you'll see his racket is on edge. The frame is pointed up towards the sky, whereas is there a way to just flip to another
you know what you could do?
I got it.
Desktop. Share desktop.
Yeah, here we go.
Nice.
No, it's still on Caroline. Wait, is it?
Oh, is it's it on Caroline.
Kevin? Is it?
No, okay. It's on Caroline.
All right, sweet. There we go. Okay, so contrast that with Caroline. When she goes back, again, her feet are much more perpendicular. They're setting up more of a right angle. You see, she actually steps to make it exactly a right angle. And so her hips and her shoulders stay exactly perpendicular to the baseline the whole time, whereas Kevin is loading and coiling and twisting and turning much, much more. And then the other main key element is the setup of her racket, which is setting up facing towards the sky. Whereas Kevin's frame was pointing upwards, her strings are facing upwards. And so those two are basically at complete opposite contrasts. Kevin's racket completely on edge, Caroline's racket completely open to the sky. Kevin's body rotated and coiled, he's a solid, just looking at it, probably like 60 degrees with his shoulders, circularly rotated past where Caroline's was. And so those two things, the body coil is loading his body to be able to then rotate and unwind up towards contact, and the racket on edge sets him up to, as he leads with his body, have the edge of the racket going up towards the ball so he can build energy and then release it powerfully into the ball. So those things are kind of the biggest contrast that I typically see with our students relative to high-level examples like Kevin.
Awesome stuff, Ian. Appreciate that. And so, with the racket, when it's like pointing up, I'm just curious, like, if there's any, you know, variability. I'm sorry, I'm using a pen and why you use a racket here, but yeah, great stuff. But, you know, like,
we get the idea.
Yeah, sure. I mean, is there any, is there any variability too, much like really the grip in terms of like, you know, having it more pointed straight up vertically, or like, can it also have some sort of like angle like this as well?
You're talking about the frame itself?
Yeah, in the trophy position.
Yeah, there is variation there for sure. You'll see some players like Kevin. In Kevin's example, you're seeing the tip of the racket basically pointing straight up towards the sky. Mm-hmm. You'll see other players with the tip of the racket pointing more back, but with the frame still leading. The edge of the racket is still leading. So that's the most important thing. I would say Kevin's kind of on one end of the spectrum, completely pointed straight upwards. A lot of players are a little bit more pointed backwards. Either one's told, yeah, this is definitely not something that we need to be super picky or legalistic about. As long as the strings are not being presented up towards the ball, then we're in good shape.
Cool. So there isn't really like an effect on the stroke really per se with those differences.
Well, the whole idea, the whole reason why any stroke would start with the racket up first is to use gravity to build momentum. So on a ground stroke, on a forehand or a backhand, the reason why 99% of professional players start with the racket head up is so that when the racket starts to fall, we've got racket head speed building without us having to build it physically and use our muscles. And so there's kind of a slingshot or a lasso effect that high level players are able to harness and use much less physical exertion to actually create racket head speed. It's the same thing on the serve. High level players will start with the racket head up so that they can allow the racket to drop with a relaxed body and then harness and kind of slingshot that momentum up towards the point of contact. And so Kevin's kind of like maximizing that by really starting with his racket head completely pointing up. If it's a little bit less than that, then we could argue that there's a little less, you know, gravity potential to create racket head speed. But I mean, as long as you're in the ballpark and you're not doing kind of like one of these like trophy poses, like with the racket on the shoulder kind of thing, as long as there's some separation and the racket is somewhat upwards so that we have room to let the racket drop, then, you know, then we're in good shape. You're not losing out on like 50 miles an hour by not having the racket up another 2 inches or whatever.
Right. Awesome. Great stuff, Ian. And then also, you know, weight distribution, you know, sometimes I see a lot of players who kind of struggle with that, or like maybe they have like all their weight on their front foot or something. So I'm just curious to ask you, you know, how we should be distributing our weight, you know, at that point.
Yeah, weight should definitely, at that point in the serve, should be shifting towards the back foot. And pretty universally, among all sports and among all shots in tennis, anytime the weight can be actively transferred forward into a strike or a transfer or some kind of delivery of energy, it's a good thing. And so there's a lot of classic serves throughout the history of tennis where the weight starts on the front foot, rocks back to the back foot, and then that enables the weight to actively be transferred back forwards again. And so when you look at Kevin, let me go back to Kevin's example here. When you look at Kevin a little bit earlier in the swing before he rotated back, you'll see that his left foot is down on the ground. Right here, he's very evenly distributed. I'm sorry, we don't have better view here of his feet, but you can see all of his left foot and see that his left foot is flat on the ground. At this point in time, he's basically just standing in a comfortable position. And I would wager that he's probably about 50-50. As he coils, you see how his left heel leaves the court. And right here, he's got significantly more weight on his back foot than on his front. And the purpose of that is to then push forwards. And you'll see that the first foot to touch down is his front foot. Mm-hmm. And so there's this transfer occurring where he's purposefully rocking and loading his weight back to his back foot so that it can be then driven forwards back onto his front foot. And again, this is just a universal principle across all sports. I mean, when you think of a baseball, I was a baseball player. When you think about a pitcher, I mean, if you've ever looked closely at a pitcher's mound, there's a big chunk of rubber that's like dug into the mound. And that's so that pitchers can plant against it and coil and then deliver forwards, transferring from their back foot onto their front foot. There's a, you know, in that particular technique, a huge stride forwards. When you think of like a football quarterback, you've got your, from the snap, a three-step drop, And if you can just kind of picture that in your mind, there's a planting on that back foot before pushing back forwards and delivering. And so it's the same thing on the serve. Initially, you want to be comfortable, evenly distributed. At some point during your initial loading, more weight should be on your back foot so that you can then transfer that energy forwards back onto your front foot again.
Awesome. That's great stuff, Ian. And so, you know, the transfer forward once you store it in the back foot primarily, I mean, does that just happens like when you're ready to strike the ball, I guess? Is that when
I would say that the weight should be most on the back foot when the body is most coiled and loaded and, you know, the spring is most tightly wound. So that ideally the entire body unwinds and unloads and uncoils and transfers all of that energy all at the same time. And this is why, you know, the serve can get really complicated, is because there's so many, the entire body is trying to coordinate and load and unload all at the same time smoothly. And so there's a lot of different moving parts. And so, yeah, ideally it should happen in unison with everything else that's been turned and rotated and loaded.
Awesome. Great stuff, Ian. And so obviously we talked about the racket drop, which is really important. And, you know, one thing that I see very often in amateur players, and just like we, you know, kind of saw with Caroline, is like the racket drop is not that great. You know, it's not very deep. So I'm just curious, you know, assuming we get all the other elements right, what are some keys to developing, you know, a good solid racket drop for us?
This is a huge one and really difficult for players to overcome a lot of times. I think if I could kind of break it into two different things, number one would be understanding what the racket drop is and what it isn't. What it is not is bending at the elbow to drop the racket down. And I see this demonstrated and used by coaches all the time, and definitely players too. This does achieve, you know, a drop position with the racket. But when you look at footage of any professional player, what's actually happening is they're maintaining a pretty big angle between their bicep and their forearm, and their shoulder is actually loading and laying back. And so this is what, on a high-level serve, creates racket drop, not this and bending at the elbow. So that's really critical. What a racket drop is the laying back, the loading of the shoulder, so that it can then be used to release and uncoil upward towards contact. It's not the forearm bending down at the elbow to drop the racket. So having explained that, the biggest, most important thing is looseness and relaxation. As the ball goes up into the air, if there's any tension at all from anywhere in the hand down to the shoulder, as the body turns forwards, the shoulder is not going to drop back. It's not going to load, because the tension in the shoulder will keep the racket from falling into that drop position. And in my experience, I mean, just across the board, tension is just the most pervasive problem that tennis players have. And I can't tell you how many dozens, probably hundreds of times, I've been told by a player, well, I'd have a better racket drop, but I just have terrible flexibility. I'm like, my range, I'm too old, like, whatever. And I'm like, oh, okay, all right. So trace through your motion, like, really slowly for me. And a lot of times I'll come up next to them and actually guide their hand and their racket through the motion. And I'll have them focus really on just tracing a circle with the tip of the racket from their trophy pose down to the bottom and then up towards contact. No faster than what I'm doing right now, just to practice the arm and the shoulder movement. I'll record them from behind and I'll be like, oh, look, the tip of your racket is at your waist. Before, on your real serve, the tip of your racket didn't go below the top of your head. And so there's like a 24 or 30 inch like difference in range of motion. And that's what the racket drop really is we're creating range of motion. We're creating a longer runway to be able to build acceleration and build energy and speed up towards the point of contact. And so if from your trophy pose, your racket only goes to here, you've got like a, you know, a foot and a half, an 18 inch, you know, runway that you have ability to accelerate up towards the point of contact. If you're dropping down to below your waist, then you've got double or triple the space to be able to build speed and build energy up towards where the ball is. What was your question originally? I don't remember.
Oh, no. I mean, you addressed it perfectly.
I don't know if I answered it or not.
No, you did. You did. And more, you know, just it was just about the racket drop and, you know, how we can achieve a good racket drop. And I think you totally answered
that. Yeah, so
that.
It comes from the shoulder and looseness mm-hmm. and kind of understanding the positions that the body should be going in. And, yeah, that's pretty
gotcha.
Much it.
Gotcha.
And then from there, like once you have the basics laid out, and you're actually stretching, you know, the right parts of the body, and you are actually allowing your shoulder to get to that position and go up towards the ball. Once a player starts to get the hang of that, the reason why you see such low, deep drops from professional players is they're not only loose and relaxed, and they're not only using the right parts of the body to load the shoulder, but they've got this big, strong uncoiling happening while their arm is loose and relaxed and loading back behind them. And it's just like a forehand lag that everybody talks about, with the body leading and the hand and the forearm and the shoulder to a certain extent kind of lagging behind. The same thing happens on a serve, where the more loose and relaxed your shoulder is and the stronger your body leads, the more separation happens between the body and the shoulder, the more stretch occurs. And so the more depth the racket drops down to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Ian, appreciate that. Great information mm-hmm. as usual. And so with the racket drop, I'm just curious. I mean, I know like you use footballs, and I'm just curious if there's any particular like tools that kind of facilitate, because it seems like, you know, maybe throwing the football, for example, might be better than like throwing just like a tennis ball or something. So I'm just curious, like what facilitates like the correct motion, if there's any tools out there.
I like football a lot, just because you get the visual feedback of whether or not it's spiraling. Yeah. The only way to throw a good spiral is to start with the tip of the football pointing forwards, load the shoulder, and then release and pronate. If at any point your palm leads facing forwards, then the tip of the football is going to be pointing away from your target, and so it's impossible to throw a spiral towards your target. That's when you start seeing the football just kind of wobble like sideways. And so it's just great visual kind of feedback as to whether or not you're doing it right. I've got a couple of videos on YouTube. One is Serve Like Joe Montana, I think is the title of the video, that kind of shows like slow motion video of Joe Montana throwing a football and comparing it to a tennis serve. And I think we've got at least one tutorial up where we show us working with a student on how to throw a football. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Rob's serve. I'll try to find that link for you. I don't remember the title of that video. But anyway, yeah, I if I had to choose like one object to train a good service motion, it would definitely be a football.
Gotcha. Good stuff. And we'll link to below this video to those videos that Ian mentioned. And so as far as, you know, we're in the trophy position, then we achieve the racket drops, racket drop, and then we want to explode up to the ball. Like, what can you walk us through, like, you know, the proper like contact of the ball as well? Like, you know, how that should be achieved?
Yeah, sure. From the racket drop, as extension starts happening up towards the ball, I saw a student recently in our trip to California that was making contact in like literally this position. Like his chest and shoulders were horizontal, and he'd been told, like everybody in the history of tennis, to swing up and reach up and extend as much as possible on a serve. And so the way he was doing that was putting his shoulder in a really compromised, like his contact was literally like above his head with his chest, like horizontal to the court. And he was like hitting from this position and following through. And so I think it's critical for players to understand that contact should be made in a stable, neutral position with the shoulder. And so there should be pretty close to a straight line across your chest, up through your arm. The only exception to that might be on more of a kick serve where contact is made a little bit further back, but on a slice serve or a flat serve, contact should be made just over your shoulder with a relatively neutral hand, not pointed upwards, and a relatively neutral shoulder, not extended up past, you know, the kind of the line of your chest or your shoulders. So yeah, that's really important for shoulder health. Important for hand and wrist health. But yeah, the most natural position is up and just out to the right for a righty, or just up and out to the left for a lefty. Shoulder position and hand position definitely really important. And if you nail those positions, it's just easy for your body to stay relaxed and fluid, and you'll feel the least amount of pain that way for sure.
Yeah, great stuff, Ian. I definitely kind of felt pain in my own shoulder just watching that technique. You know, it looks like a one-arm hang, which is
I strolled past it. Let me see if I can find it really. I don't know. I don't really want to call this guy out, I guess.
No, I mean, everyone.
But it was interesting. Like, I've never seen it kind of exaggerated that much before. But it's one of those things. It's like, good advice, but taken to an extreme. And I see that all the time. Like, there's so many phrases that just get repeated again and again and again and again. And some players are very audible in how they internalize information. And so they'll interpret it super, super literally. And you end up with stuff like that. Happens all the time with tennis players. I know it's in here somewhere. Here it is. Yeah, check this. I wasn't exaggerating. So yeah, here's that contact point. Check this out.
Oh wow, I see.
Right. Dang. And so his like chest and his shoulders are level, but his arm is straight up and his racket is straight up and he's making contact like right over his head. So contrast that with Kevin. Kevin's our ultimate example today.
Yeah, this is a great serve.
And so you'll see at contact, he's got a straight line from his left shoulder to his right elbow to his right hand, and he's in alignment all across his upper body. And so this is just the strongest, most stable, most athletic, most comfortable position to make contact from. And again, you'll see his hand in a neutral position here. It's not rotated to the right or to the left, not flexed forwards. And so, yeah, this is the position ultimately that we're trying to achieve.
Great stuff, Ian. Appreciate that. And so, oh,
not this.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So, and also, you know, maybe I should have mentioned this a bit earlier, but, you know, the toss, just kind of some general thoughts on that. You know, what are some keys to creating like a very consistent, optimal toss for us and, you know, some reasons why maybe it could, our tosses go awry?
I think in a nutshell, the answer is hinge points. There should only be one hinge point on your toss, and that should be at your shoulder. As soon as you start hinging at the elbow, or you start hinging at the wrist, or you start hinging at the fingers, or God forbid, all three at the same time, then the variance of like where the ball could possibly go is just like all over the place. And so I think it's really key for players to learn to be comfortable lifting exclusively from the shoulder. And that allows their hand to stay relaxed. There's no like flipping or cupping or scooping or rolling or whatever the heck else you can do with that body part, which just adds just a lot of volatility to where the ball could go. So for me, it really just comes down to that. I mean, you'll hear a lot of other advice about tossing. At the end of the day, it's just about repeatability. And frankly, when you watch professional players, you'll see all kinds of different, you know, deliveries and styles. And I've known lots of really talented athletic people, like much better players and athletes than me, that have had all kinds of inconsistency problems with their toss. It wasn't so much because they had poor mechanics. It was just because it's kind of a subtle, like, nuance, like it's a touch like thing, placing the ball in exactly the right spot over and over and over again. So I think it comes down to cleaning up any superfluous movements or hinging, and then just putting in the reps to get really comfortable with it and make it really, really repeatable. It's I mean, it should be a really simple thing. If you're having a lot of volatility, then you're either overcomplicating the motion with too many moving parts, or you just haven't trained good repeatability.
All right. Gotcha. Good stuff, Ian. And so, you know, moving there, well, at least from the contact point, I know like sometimes there's a tendency to have different finishes, like depending on what types of serves. So I was wondering if you could describe for us like the common types of finishes, like depending on what type of serve you're hitting.
When you say finish, do you mean the very, very end of the motion, or do you mean from contact, what direction the racket is moving?
Well, let's actually go with what direction it's moving. So we go piecemeal like that.
I've got just the video for you.
Yeah, excellent.
Uh-huh. All right. So here you see our student, Phil. Great player. Like, he's a 4-5 player coming in to work with us. All he had was a spin serve. And he didn't have anything other than just kind of your standard run-of-the-mill slice serve. And so I've paused this video right here to show two very different directions of swing. On the left side, we see a flat serve. And what flat serve means is that the focus of energy and acceleration is going through the ball towards the target in alignment. And so you see the tip of his racket pointing out towards the other side of the court. His arm and his shoulder have extended out towards the other side of the court. And on the right side is him learning how to hit a topspin serve. And so his swing path here has gone much more along the baseline, whereas his swing path on the flat serve has bisected the baseline and gone through the baseline. And this is something that very few players, most players just have like their standard like delivery. And they'll swing fast on their first serve and slow on their second serve. And they don't really have any kind of real variation in how they swing the racket. And so we actually have several videos showing us working with students on this topic. And that is learning how to accelerate through and towards the target to hit a direct flat delivery. And at about a 45-degree angle into the court to create side spin, and up and along the baseline, parallel to the baseline, to create topspin. And those are your three basic deliveries. And most players only have one of those. If you can get all three, then you become much, much more difficult to return, because you're able to mix up your deliveries and give your opponents different looks. But it comes down to that. It comes down to direction of swing. And so depending on which direction you swing in, you hit different type of spin, different type of delivery. And that's something that not many players understand or have taken the time to develop.
Gotcha. Great stuff, Ian. And also kind of going back to like holding ourselves at sideways position, I was wondering, mm-hmm. you know, how long we want to hold ourselves in that sideways position. And does that vary at all between the different types of serves that you're hitting?
Yeah, it does. On a kick serve, where, as I mentioned a second ago, the swing path is super, super vertical and very much along the baseline. If you can imagine, again, kind of my target or intended direction of shot being towards the camera, on a kick serve, you'll see players stay sideways until after contact and then release and turn forwards into the court. Whereas on a flat serve on the other end of the spectrum, where I'm trying to accelerate through the ball and towards my target, the body definitely opens up much sooner to facilitate that direction of acceleration. And so it's very much a question of where am I trying to swing the racket. On a kick serve, it's this way. And on a flat serve, it's this way. And so you'll see different body alignment to facilitate that, those different directions of swing. I don't want to get people thinking too much or overcomplicate it too much. But that being said, if you're trying to develop different deliveries, then you've got to have your body facing in the right direction. And so at contact on most serves, your body should be short of parallel to the net or to the baseline. Flat serve would be most turned forwards, but even there, contact should be made a little bit short of parallel. Slice serve be a little bit further back, and kick serve will be really chest almost perpendicular to the baseline still, and really allowing a very, very vertical and out to the right delivery and release for a right-handed player. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks so much for kind of making those distinguishing, techniques for us. And so kind of just getting to the end of the technical spectrum here, I was wondering, you know, kind of the role of the left hand, you know, kind of how that's working for us during the serve.
Yeah, I think it does two things. Number one, really helps facilitate a vertical alignment up towards the ball in the first place. And this is a huge fundamental difference, again, between kind of beginner or intermediate players and advanced players. We talked earlier about the amount of initial kind of turn or load or coil is a big distinguishing difference. And just to kind of highlight this, another big distinguishing difference is the pitch or angle at which the body is aligned. And so on our amateur example of Caroline, if we back up a little bit and see her initial setup position, it looks like she's vertical simply because her left arm is high. And this is her trophy pose right about here. But if you look at her shoulders, you'll see that she's actually, in reality, she's very flat. And so she's in a position where her shoulders are level, but her left arm is high. And so it's like, see, I'm swinging up. But the body is actually aligned very, very straight towards the target. And that is that by the way, is super, super, probably 80-90% of tennis players across all levels are basically set up like that, where it's like they've been told to leave their tossing arm up and it's up there, but it doesn't actually get the rest of the body aligned properly, which it should be vertical up towards contact. So here's Kevin. Let's back him up a little bit. So you'll see the difference. Like his tossing arm is really similar to Caroline's, but remember how we pointed out that alignment across Kevin's chest up towards contact? He's doing the same thing on his initial setup, but now his left arm is high and his right arm is low. And so his entire upper body is actually tilted to be aligned up in that vertical position. So this is the first thing that the left arm does. And I just, hopefully I'm not overcomplicating things, but just wanted to point out that just because your left arm is high doesn't mean that you're actually lining your body up correctly. And this alignment up towards the ball is really important, because without the upper body actually tilting, we're accelerating forwards. And that's really problematic in terms of margin over the top of the net. It's very problematic in terms of creating topspin and creating rotation on the ball down towards the other side of the court. And so left arm high is great, but if you can get the rest of your body aligned in that direction, then that's ultimately kind of what we're going for. And then from that vertically aligned position, the left arm also helps in rotating the body up towards the ball by dropping and tucking in. And I think that the left arm being high has been emphasized so much that a lot of times I've seen multiple times with our students that they actually leave it up too long. They end up getting trapped and their body doesn't actually unwind up towards the ball. So yes, absolutely get it up there. But it also has to fall or else the body can't rotate forwards. And so it's a matter of letting it drop at the right time so that the chest can rotate, and the left arm can actually aid in helping the chest and the shoulders rotate up towards contact. I like to use the analogy of like watching figure skating and watching them set up for a spin. And I can't demonstrate that at all, but they'll start with their arms out and then pull them in to kind of really accelerate the spin on the ice. And it's the same thing on a serve where arm starts extended, and then you'll see all professional players pull that arm in to help them really accelerate the body's rotation up towards the point of contact.
Awesome. I really, really love how you explained that, Ian. So good stuff. The left arm is very, very important. So use it properly, like as Ian said. So, I mean, really the last part of it, and, you know, we did discuss this a bit in the beginning, and we've seen Kevin, how he lands, you know, with his left foot. But, you know, obviously we have players, and I've even seen lessons on YouTube with you where you're trying to help a player who, like, steps across into the court with their right foot. Like, why is that not optimal? For righty, at least.
It's not – you can still hit a good serve that way. Anytime we publish a lesson that focuses on that, somebody's like, oh, look at Bjorn Borg from 19 – like
Bjorn Creek.
yeah. Everybody always had – or what's the other one? I think Roscoe Tanner is the other one. Everybody on YouTube is like, oh, just look at Roscoe Tanner like 40 years ago. And I'm like, thanks, bro. but, yeah, it's not optimal because – if the left foot gets stuck, the only reason why the right foot should pass the left foot is if the left foot gets stuck down on the court. And so if you're using your legs and the rest of your body actively enough to leave the court, then as you – let's see, let me get this a little bit lower. As you transfer upwards towards the point of contact – if you leave the court and you have loaded onto your back foot and pushed upwards, it just makes sense to catch yourself on your other foot. If your left foot gets stuck down and you push up, then it absolutely kind of will lead you to stepping across and using your right foot to kind of lead the touchdown across the other side of the baseline. So I think the key elements are, did you leave the court? If the answer is no, then okay, then it doesn't really matter. Or probably it's most natural for you to use your right foot. I think that's fine. If you're okay with not driving more powerfully up towards the ball. The other question is, was your weight distributed correctly? Meaning more on your right foot initially to drive up and towards your left foot. If you do that effectively and both feet leave the court, then I think the left foot touching down just makes natural sense.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I personally want to create a third option where you like land really powerfully on both feet and then just, you know, clench your fist, but I guess that's probably not.
in like a whole position. Like, I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, I just watched too many of those movies. But anyway, great stuff, Ian. Well, I mean, this was, you know, fantastic information. I really appreciate, I mean, to the depth of and specifics of how you explain the serve. And obviously, want to educate, you know, the audience for those of you who actually don't know about essential tennis, which probably is not that big of a percentage. I just want to, you know, ask you, Ian, to kind of explain about, you know, the essential tennis philosophy and then the types of resources and things that people can check out, you know, on your site and also your YouTube channel and other social media platforms.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I would say our philosophy is definitely in our name of essential tennis. Like the reason why I named the website Essential Tennis was because I have a passion for focusing on the fundamentals of technique. And I have a passion for kind of getting to the most critical fundamental elements of a motion or a movement pattern and just focusing on that. What excites me most when I'm working with a student is when I choose one thing for them to focus on and they focus on it. And then two or three other things improve automatically as a result. And then like, that's what makes me most happy, because I know that I chose like the most like effective, essential element to focus on. So that's definitely kind of our philosophy, is to be very narrowly focused on the most important stuff, not get too sidetracked into more nuanced or stylistic, you know, debates about technique. And so, yeah, that's Essential Tennis in a nutshell. This month marks 10 years since we started publishing online.
Wow.
Which I'm definitely happy about. Can't believe it's been a decade. It's kind of crazy.
But there's,
yeah, for sure. But there's 8 of us now that are working full time on the team here. There's 4 of us coaches. There are 2 full-time video production people, a marketing person, and another video product. Yeah, there's three video production people now that are full-time. It's hard for me to keep track, because we have like all kind of other part-time, you know, contractors that work on our editing and publishing. But yeah, our goal is just to continue to expand and grow and bring more really passionate team members on that love coaching, that love explaining, breaking things down, that love creating content. And we're trying to make the biggest impact on the tennis world that we can.
Well, that's fantastic. And you know, like I mentioned, I mean, you put out a lot of amazing content, really high quality. I mean, even, you know, all the free stuff on YouTube, just a lot of great stuff. The lessons are super cool and really, really great stuff. And just want to ask too, you know, obviously you talked about the philosophy of Essential Tennis and the team members, and you know, what types of resources and things can we check out from you guys?
I think our YouTube, if you want to like really kind of follow us, and the best place, I think, is probably our YouTube channel. That's where we're most focused on publishing the highest, as you said, like we're definitely obsessive about just always improving the quality of our stuff, both in terms of the actual, how good, you know, it looks, and like the quality of the production, but also making it as engaging and interesting to watch as possible. The other main place would be Facebook. Pretty much all the same content gets published in both places. We publish at least 5 new videos a week in both places, whether that be a tutorial or a lesson actually showing us working with a student, changing their strokes and helping them improve. We're starting to really focus on Instagram just recently. So YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, definitely the places to go to be exposed to the stuff that we're producing and creating. Then we have a huge list of courses that are paid. All the stuff I just talked about is all free content. There's more than enough to keep you busy on those platforms. But if you go to essentialtennis.com and click on courses, then you'll see a list of the super comprehensive, detailed, like in-depth courses on all different parts of the game that we've created there.
Oh, wonderful stuff, Ian. And so if people want to connect with you or the team, I mean, are there any particular like social media profiles? Like, I know you mentioned Instagram, but is there like a handle that we could follow?
Yeah, Instagram is at Essential Tennis. We don't use Twitter, but that's at Essential Tennis. Facebook is facebook.com/EssentialTennis. Yeah, those three would definitely be Facebook and Instagram. Don't try to connect with us on Twitter. You probably won't get an answer for like 2 years.
That's why I've been repeatedly messaging you guys, and no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah.
Damn. That's great. Well, you know, before I let you go in, because I really do appreciate your time. I mean, you know, spending all this time with us here today. But I just want to ask you to close. It's a very classic question of mine, and people are probably getting tired of it. But what is one key actionable tip that you can give our audience to help them improve their tennis serves?
Just go record yourself. I'm gonna go back to that. And I've been, again, like preaching this for a decade now, and everybody has the hardware, everybody has the software, but I would, and this audience, like whoever, God bless you, you're still like watching at this point, you know, what are we, like an hour and a half in, you're definitely like the most passionate, like engaged, driven, you know, motivated person to make improvements on your game. But even out of those of you still watching, I bet definitely less than 50% of your average tennis audience, it's like 4%, 3% of players have ever seen themselves on video. It just blows me away. Every time we go to California, every year we spend a month in California. We do coaching, group clinics, private students. And the first thing I always ask in our group clinics, I do a private session with each of our students. First question I always ask is, have you seen yourself on video? And the answer of those players who like follow us, they paid a bunch of money, they spent 2 days with us, and it's like, hey, have you ever seen yourself on video? And the answer is almost always no. And so I just know the percentages are super low, and I know how much if you're watching now and you haven't recorded yourself, you're leaving a tremendous amount of improvement on the table. So I gotta go with that. There's no bigger single thing that your viewers can do than see the truth of how they're actually moving their bodies. So definitely record yourself on video. I know it's intimidating, but you might as well know the truth like everybody else already does on the courts.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to keep an open mind, be willing to, be criticized, and improve from there. So Ian, I can't thank you enough. You've really given so much to the tennis community. Like, I mean, you've spent probably, thousands and thousands of hours, like even just producing free content. Your free content is, probably higher quality than most paid content. And
That's literally our goal, by the way. Yeah, we want our free stuff to be better than everybody else's paid stuff. So I'm happy to hear you say that.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. It's the truth. So I really, obviously, highly, highly encourage everybody to check out Essential Tennis. There's links below this video, so just please click them. I mean, you have to if you're a serious tennis player, or if you even just want to check out cool videos. So because you guys have funny ones too. But thank you so much, Ian, and keep up the great work, you and the team at Essential Tennis, and I really do appreciate all your time and efforts.
Absolutely. Yeah, great to talk to you again. Great job with the Tennis Summit. You keep adding to that and improving it each year, which is awesome to see. I know how much work it is. Not many people know how much work it is. So kudos to you for putting in all the hours to organize and create the content and make all the pages work and all that stuff. So keep up the good work, and I'm happy to help.
Thanks so much, Ian. All the best to you.